Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to call the meeting of the House Committee on Rules to order for Thursday, May 18th, 2017. Another reminder that the clock in the back is wrong, so don't look at that if you want to know what time it is. All right, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3440.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3440, we had a work session on the 11th, at which time we heard about the Dash 3 Amendment, which replaces the underlying measure. The Dash 3 Amendment prohibits permits pharmacist, pharmacy, healthcare professional, or any person designated by State Board of Pharmacy to administer naloxone and distribute necessary medical supplies to administer naloxone. It does a number of other provisions. I will turn it over to the state epidemiologist to talk about the measure.
Great. Thank you. Welcome.
Yes, thank you. Chair Williamson, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg. I'm the state health officer and epidemiologist with the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here to present information on the Dash 3 amendments to 3440 and how these provisions will help address the opioid overdose epidemic. So over the past 15 years, not only Oregon, but the rest of the United States has seen a marked increase in opioid overdose deaths and hospitalizations. Luckily, that some of that death rate has leveled off and has declined slightly, or I should say modestly, since 2011. Nonetheless, our current death rate from opioids is three times what it was in 2000. In 2016, opioids were prescribed at a rate of 960 fills per 1,000 residents. That's almost enough for one opioid prescription bottle for every adult or resident in Oregon. We also have the second highest rate of non-medical use of opioid pain medication. So to address this, the Oregon Health Authority, we have a framework that includes a number of strategies, decreasing the amount of opioids that are in the community through prescribing guidelines, alternative pain strategies. We also increase the availability of naloxone rescue, increasing access to medication-assisted treatment for those who are addicted to opioids, as well as using data. So within OHA, we have an opioid initiative work group, and we work in conjunction with partners within healthcare systems, not-for-profit, local health departments, regional coalitions, licensing boards, professional. So the point is it takes a lot of different people. There's not one single strategy that's going to help. We recently, last fall, I guess, published the Oregon Opioid Prescribing Guidelines, and they've been endorsed by numerous professional associations and licensing boards. And we've seen success with this, with the strategies. We've actually seen a decrease in the first quarter of 2016. We saw a 10% decrease. I'm sorry, in the fourth quarter of 2016, 10%. And then in the first quarter of 2017, a 15% decrease in prescribing. So we're starting to make progress. We're not quite there. House Bill 3440-3 includes several elements that will enhance our statewide efforts to address this. Allowing certain healthcare providers and pharmacists, currently they can prescribe and dispense naloxone, but allowing them to administer naloxone will be very helpful. Removing any prior authorization for entry into medication-assisted treatment, having specialty courts for those receiving MAT, and also being able to, again, report out and analyze the data. We currently have a web-based data system where people can access that, and we will be sure that those data are updated at least quarterly so we can make these data available to everyone who needs to use them. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, colleagues. All right. Thank you very much. All right. I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 3440.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3440.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 3440. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes.
And for the record, Madam Chair, this measure does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
And Madam Chair, with that, I move House Bill 3440 as amended with a due pass recommendation that the measure be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved House Bill 3440 with a due pass recommendation as amended to be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3440. And colleagues, I'm going to move into our work sessions. We are not going to work 2349. Today, we're waiting on paperwork, I believe. So with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2428.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2428 was originally heard on March 7th. The original measure allows candidate one business day to pay fee for candidate space and voters pamphlet if it was determined they did not have the appropriate amount of signatures turned in on their petition. We tried to work with the calendar and Secretary of State's office to minimize the fiscal impact to make this measure work. It was quite difficult, so we have a new idea, which is the Dash 1 Amendment, which allows a candidate to submit both the fee and the signatures to the Secretary of State. If the signatures are verified, they get the fee back. If the signatures are not verified, they don't have enough, they have the fee already paid, and they have their space in the voters pamphlet after the deadline has passed, so they are still being able to be included. We have a minimal fiscal impact and a no revenue impact on the Dash 1.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2428.
Vice Chair McLean has moved the Dash 1 amendment to, wait, oh, that's wrong. I won't read mine. To House Bill 2428. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2428 to the floor with a do pass as amended recommendation.
Vice Chair McLean has moved House Bill 2428 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes. Carrier will be Representative Parrish. I will close the work session on House Bill 2428. I will open a work session on House Bill 2873.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2873 was originally heard on March 23rd. The measure requires governing body of municipal corporation to publish an ORSTAR notice of election involving local tax option measure or general obligation bond measure. You have a Dash 4 amendment. It clarifies that if a municipal corporation places a local option tax measure or general obligation bond measure on the ballot, the authorized chief elections officer for the city, county, or district must file those materials with the appropriate county elections officer. The county elections officer will be the one who submits the materials to the Secretary of State for publication on ORSTAR. You have a minimal fiscal impact and a no revenue impact on the Dash 4 amendment.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 2873.
Vice Chair McLean has moved the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2873. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2873 as to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Vice Chair McLean has moved House Bill 2873 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? As amended.
I have one question. This was a committee bill, is that correct? Is this a committee bill? And I don't recall, but if it was a committee bill, then obviously, Madam Chair, you knew about it. So remind me again, after looking at it, what is the problem we're solving here?
Sure, if I may, Madam Chair, because I had folks request a few amendments to this. Basically, what it is we are looking for the ability to use ORSTAR to have one central repository for all of the zillions of bond measures. I'm sorry, I shouldn't be flippant because I'm not trying to be, but the many bond measures for all the many variety of special districts throughout the state, so that there can be one page, so that they have paperwork that you have to file when you're doing a bond sale. And this basically allows through each of the counties, either each of the 36 counties, all the elections in their county, they submit that form to the county clerk, they submit it to ORSTAR, and then you can go on ORSTAR and see all of the bonds that are up in any election cycle.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Was this Representative McEwen was working on this too, I believe, wasn't she?
I don't think so.
I believe she had a different one that had to do with
the posting and the ability to post in the voters pamphlet a community college bond.
Right.
Yeah.
This is
Caddy's was a little bit different.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative McEwen had a measure that would allow community colleges to get their materials in the statewide voters pamphlet if their county that the community college district resides in did not publish one for an election. So if they had a bond measure going out for a community college, and that passed the House.
We have a motion on the measure.
All right.
That's
any the same one any further discussions?
No.
It's just a big breath. All right. Any objections? Motion passes. Carrier be Representative Smith-Warner. I will close the work session on House Bill 2873. I will open a work session on House Bill 2927.
All right. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2927 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved House Bill 2927 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, sure.
Vice Chair McClain.
Madam Chair, I understand this is the national popular vote.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2927, which was originally heard on the 14th of March, does enact Oregon's participation in the Interstate Compact for the national popular vote.
And may I, yes. So the House passed it in 09. It died in 11. It was passed in 13 and passed in 15. And in perhaps there's a virtue in consistency. And we're going to pass it, I assume, mainly on a party line vote in 17. And this has never passed the Senate, correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it has not.
Okay. Well, I'll be opposing today, Madam Chair, for all sorts of reasons, none of which I can tell you want to hear, but they're very important.
Why has that stopped you before?
It's never stopped me before. Today it's sunny. And we all want to go home, don't we?
Today don't he's we? Feeling uncharacteristically restrained.
Representative Barreto.
That's awesome.
He wants to roll vote sun too.
All right. Further discussions. Representative Rayfield, don't make it any worse.
I just thought I would say that I'm going to be supporting it for all sorts of reasons.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Okay. Everyone just keep those inside.
That's some compelling
testimony.
All right.
Testimony. Sam, can we call the roll?
Representative
Barreto?
No.
Representative
Pack? Nicely done. No.
Aye.
Representative Kemmer? Excused.
Representative
Nose?
Yes.
Representative
Smith-Warner?
Aye.
Vice Chair McClain? No.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
Chair Williamson? Yes. Motion passes. Carrier will be Representative Kenny Geyer. Close the work session on House Bill 2927. I will open a work session on House Bill 3203A. Is that what I'm doing?
A little out of order, but that's okay.
Yeah.
We have a couple panels, Madam Chair.
Oh. Actually, I'm going to close the work session on that, and I'm going to open first a work session on HJR 10.
Oh, look at that.
Work session?
A work session on what?
HJR 10.
Madam Chair, I move HJR 10 to the floor with a B adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair McClain has moved HJR 10 to the floor with a B adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections?
Yes. We need a roll call.
We can do a roll call.
No. Okay.
Representative
Barreto?
Aye.
Representative Pack?
Aye.
Representative
Shame you.
Aye.
Representative Hammer? Excused.
Representative Nose?
Yes.
Representative Smith-Warner?
No.
Vice Chair McClain?
Yes.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
Yes, motion passes. The carrier will be Representative Hack. We'll close the work session on HJR 10. Now we will open a work session on House Bill 3203A.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3203 comes to you from your House Business and Labor Committee. It requires contracting agency to determine whether contracting public improvement projects with own staff and equipment will result in least cost to agency. You have two amendments before you, Madam Chair. You have the -A3 amendments and you have the -A7 amendments. I believe there are people here who are better equipped to talk about both these amendments than I am, Madam Chair. And so I will defer to those individuals.
All right, Bill Kirby and Mike Eliason.
I
report.
Madam Chair, I'm Bill Kirby, City Attorney for the City of Beaverton. I'm here to speak as a member of a public agency about what we see Dash 3 and Dash 7 amendments accomplishing. In a nutshell, I would tell you that House Bill 3203A has essentially three components. Simply put, how to do a cost analysis, when to do a cost analysis, and what happens if you do the cost analysis incorrectly. So we break that down into analysis, thresholds, and enforcement. I'll explain how the Dash 3 and Dash 7 amendments affect each of these three areas, and then I'll answer any questions you may have. The Dash 3 amendments, with regard to analysis, we've been in disputes for many years with contractors about how to properly do this analysis of what does it cost for in-house work to be done. We get our budgets audited every year. Our accountants say we're doing it correctly. One of the things they're supposed to look at is whether or not we're complying with ORS 279A, B, and C. But we still have this dispute. So the best thing to do is just come together, and we have, negotiate out what is a reasonable way of doing a cost analysis, settle on that, and then we will do that. This bill, both the Dash 3 and the Dash 7, accomplish that. It's a reasonable step forward in trying to no longer have disputes about how do you do a cost analysis. Now, with regard to when to do a cost analysis, that's the issue of thresholds. You don't want to do a cost analysis on the first dollar of expenditure. Back in 1997, a threshold was established. It's not been updated since 1997. We would like to update that threshold to say in the Dash 3 amendments that a threshold would be required for all public improvements except for roadway improvements if the project is going to cost more than $250,000. With regard to roadway improvements, the thresholds would be $200,000 and 2 inches of road disturbance. That's what we'd like to do. And then in the Dash 3 amendments, it then indexes that so that we don't have this issue of decades going by and not having that threshold being updated. That's the proposal in the Dash 3 amendments. In the Dash 7 amendments in regard to thresholding, it takes a little different approach. What it does is it says that, rather than having a cost of living index kind of an idea, what it would do instead it would stair step. It would start at $200,000 this year, and we would agree that it would increase to $300,000 over a 10-year period for all public improvements except roadways. With regard to roadways, what would happen is we would start with an increase of $175,000, a little bit less than that, $200,000. Still have that 2 inches of roadway not being disturbed, and then stair-step that up to $250,000 over 10 years. Either approach is appropriate. We can live with either approach, but what needs to happen is somehow there has to be a mechanism in here to update that threshold about when you do a cost analysis. Now, the next thing is enforcement. It is a legitimate concern of the contracting agencies that when something happens and they don't think that it's been done correctly, there's not a good enforcement mechanism in Oregon law correctly right now to what they're supposed to do. We've sat down and we've agreed to, with the help of Bully and legislative counsel, to a process that allows for an enforcement mechanism. It is what I call progressive discipline. If you find one violation, your first violation, you get a warning, you get educated, you get an opportunity to bully to say you're doing it wrong, here's how you're supposed to do it correctly on these cost analyses. The next time, you have to reach some sort of settlement agreement with bully in terms of how you're going to do things properly. It's much more detailed. The third time, you can end up with a $5,000 fine if you're negligent in how you're doing your cost analysis, or up to a $20,000 fine if you're willfully not doing your cost analyses correctly or completely ignoring them. This is appropriate. We've talked about what the process should look like, and I think that we can recommend that be part of any bill that comes forward. We recommend the Dash 7 amendments, and we hope that you can support that. Any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. And Chair Williamson, members of the committee, Michael Eisen with the Association of Oregon Counties, I think Mr. Landauer and I are basically here to help answer any questions should they arise, but concur with everything Mr. Kirby said and urge your support of the amendment.
Yes, Colby.
Well, thank you. I remember this bill from the Business and Labor Committee and had a good hearing, but there was a lot of disagreement about the bill. I was hoping that sending it to rules and allowing the time for you guys to have a conversation to come to, you know, a better agreement. Somebody shared the dash three. I did have a little bit of concern, so I appreciate the dash seven. I'm wondering how close, and I'm probably will hear from others, but how close do you think you are to an agreement?
Chair Williamson, Representative Holvey, as Mr. Kirby said, I think we are essentially, and I know we'll hear from others, I think, but I think we've reached agreement on essentially two of the three main components, and we've tried to put in place a reasonable but not extremely high increase to that 1997 threshold. So won't speak for others, but I think we've reached agreement on many of the core components, but not all of them.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did share some of your concern to make sure that your public works crews, you know, that you had adequate public works crews that had the skills and the experience and the ability to keep working so that they can handle the maintenance they need to handle and emergencies should they arise, and but at the same time making sure that when projects are too big that they should be bid out to the private sector. You feel the dash seven has met that balance for you?
Yeah, Chair Williamson, Representative Holvey, we do feel like it strikes a reasonable balance, and we feel really good about the new accountability measures that are put in place on the enforcement side, so that should an agency either be blatantly ignoring the cost analysis requirements or doing it blatantly incorrectly, there's a mechanism now in place for a contracting community to file a complaint and go through a process that would result again in that sort of progressive discipline approach. Whereas right now, that really doesn't exist at all.
Questions for this panel? All right, thank you very much. Rich, do you want to come on?
Good afternoon. Rich Hankstrom, the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. I get the privilege of being Mike Dewey, John Rakowitz, Rich Hankstrom, and John Hickey all at the same time
privilege,
today.
Privilege, huh?
Yeah, right. So I'm wearing a lot of hats. I appreciate the committee's attention to this. I want to first say our coalition, it's important the committee know who our coalition is. It's a good mix of folks from Associated General Contractors, Building Trades, Associated Builders and Contractors, Northwest Utility Contractors, OCAPA, Oregon Chapter of Northwest Electrical Contractors, Associated Wall and Ceiling Contractors, Knife River, Cal Portland, Old Castle Materials, Baker Rock Resources, and Wilish. Because I may get cut off at some point, I'm going to start at the end. So I'm going to talk about what I think we should do in this bill from the coalition's perspective. First, I think it's important to know that Senator Boquist has a work group, and I believe Senator Smith Warner has joined that work group. We did make great progress. We are in an impasse over the thresholds, because the thresholds and the exception, the two-inch issue, create some struggles that we haven't been able to get through yet, and I'll go through those in a little bit. The author of the bill is Representative Brian Clem, and Brian Clem does have an amendment. I just got it. It's the dash six. I haven't had a chance to review it, so I decided not to drop it yet because it would be last minute. I know the sevens were last minute. I haven't had a chance to review those yet. My concern, what we think should happen is that the bill the areas of agreement should be put into the bill, and I think all versions of that is where we're at. But the areas of disagreement should not be put in the bill because we think it's important while the work group's going on, neither side game it. And I'm going to go through why that's kind of the case with the amendments, at least, that we've looked at. Oregon has an important policy when it relates to public contracting. And that is, it's a policy of the state of Oregon that contracting agencies shall make every effort to construct public improvements at the least cost to the taxpayer. This policy ensures the wise use of the money, and it ensures transparency of the expenditures. It's a good policy. Current law requires that any job that's under 125,000 could be self-performed. 125,000 does about a mile of road, depending on some, you've got to give some color to it because in the city it might be a little less and out in the country it might be a little more, but both lanes. So it's actually quite a bit, the threshold's already quite high. And when you look at the other states, it's important that I bring this up. The other states, Idaho just moved to 50 from 10 to 50, I believe, and it's a cap. In Washington, it's 60 and 90 cap, depending on the size of the city. So a smaller city is 60, a larger city is 90. California, with more color, because California doesn't do anything that's not complicated, is around 45,000. We're almost twice that already, and with these amendments, it significantly increases. The policy for that is we're essentially asking, before the comparison is done, that the agencies at some level start thinking about how they're spending the money. It's a free pass to 125. Nobody accounts for it. But at 125, they have to look as whether they can do it cheaper than the private sector. What's important with that is, let me say it this way. The coalition over the last 4 or 5 years that I've been involved in this issue has looked very closely and tabulated a number of abuses that have happened. And I think the committee should know that we have seen large projects broken up so that they would be within the 125 constraint. We've seen local governments not even know the law and just doing whatever. We've tabulated those. On the asphalt side, actually, which is the other area of contention, we've seen the most problem. We've seen bids go out at 2 inches and paving at 3 and 4 inches. In fact, recently I just had another one come in. We've seen them stacking lifts to stay under the 2-inch threshold. But the important part of that, and what our let me say this, our part of the bill, and what we've kind of broken it up into 5 parts, the accounting principles we've agreed to, the law enforcement procedures we've agreed to. We've done a great job defining maintenance and what's preservation. We've solved the problem with ODOT. We've given them all the chip seal jobs they can do, and we've tried to define that more carefully so contractors and the local governments that are doing it know what those divisions are. And that's in the current bill that came over. The working groups are in agreement on 3 of 5 of those, but they're not in agreement on the threshold, and they're not in agreement on the 2-inch. And I only have 4 or 5 more points, and then I'll be done. We look, the threshold issues that they're increasing to are 200 and 250, and I haven't looked at the 7, so I don't know, Representative Smith-Warner, where that came from yet. But what we did is to try to, as far as the negotiation with the local governments, is we looked at 11 jurisdictions across the state. We took every single job, and it ended up being 108 jobs. And this is an important stat, and I'm going to say it twice because I think it's hugely important to the threshold issue. 72% of them fell under the $125,000 threshold, 72%. I've asked local governments to provide me other jurisdictions if they didn't like the ones we did, and we would run those numbers. But essentially, where the threshold is at now, almost three-quarters of the jobs can be self-performed. If you raise the threshold to $200,000 or $250,000, it essentially means that every job can be performed by the local governments without any accountability, without any transparency. In fact, I've looked at the numbers, and I went over them with some folks today, that there's very few jobs that are even over $500,000. We only found one job that was over $1 million. And now that's excluding ODOT, because ODOT does many, many, many miles, and so those are generally pretty high. So, but the struggle here for us, and where this whole debate comes down to, is who's going to perform the work. We think what the local governments are trying to do with their amendments is avoid the accounting provision so they just don't have to do it, be able to perform all the work themselves, and avoid that transparency that we think is very important in the law. The threshold, we're in agreement on the utility side that it needs to be race, because they made a great argument during the negotiations that the cost of those jobs need to be higher, but not on the paving side. And we don't think we should reward the number of abuses we've seen with the 2-inch threshold, which really has kind of is the exception that has just generally taken over the whole entire rule and has made it kind of unworkable. My suggestion as a last comment is that we look at the dash six so nobody can game it. We get back to our work group and we try to hash out the last 2 points, which is what is an appropriate threshold that ensures transparency, ensures a lot of work goes out to the private sector, but we keep the public sector busy. The numbers that they are suggesting are really kind of unfair, and when you look at it from that perspective. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony and thank the committee and the chair for time to come in and give me a little extra time to walk through it. Appreciate that.
Thank you, Rich. And it's from my understanding that at least in my district, you get less than a block for $125,000 in the city of Portland.
So. Madam Chair, that could be if they're doing grinding along with it and curb maintenance. And then it would be a public improvement anyway, by the way, if they did those things. If they do any grinding or curb work, it would be a public improvement regardless.
So, questions? All right.
I have a question. Well, is the dash 7 a consensus? I gather it's not yet.
It's not.
Okay. Just to sum it up.
Yeah, the sixes, when they come out, will have everything that's agreed and the current law that we haven't agreed to left in place. So if we just don't think one side at this point or the other, while we're in a work group, it's appropriate to move something that advantages one side or the other.
And
thank you.
Madam Chair, just to be clear, the dash sevens are the dash sevens are the same as the dash fives, which I know we've talked about before. With an addition of a cap on that less than 2 inches paving. So that was indeed another move to try to bring some balance into this. And it is not a final response. I believe, having been involved in talking extensively with both Senator Boquist and checking in regularly with Representative Clem, I think it's helpful to continue to push. This is a conversation that has been going on for about the last 6 to 8 years. I had a long conversation with Representative Bence about this yesterday, and there was good feeling about trying to push this conversation forward and continue to make sure those both sides do indeed continue to talk.
Chair Williamson, Representative Smith Warner. The dash values have 750,000 as that line, right?
Right, but there was an accidental. It had a stair step up, which was taken out in the dash sevens. I believe that's the only. Oops, sorry, Madam Chair.
In the
only change
in the examples that we've looked at, all of those jurisdictions, I don't believe there's one from last year's project that reached 750,000. So essentially, with that, there would be none of that cost comparison. That's the key part to the least cost policy. It just simply, for sure, we get the advantage of doing the work, but even from a public policy perspective, from our view, having the local governments understand what their cost structure are and do that simple comparison to make sure, because see, this is a key to this whole thing. There's no limitation on any version of local governments being able to do any amount of job they want. They only have to do the comparison at 125 or whatever, you know, the threshold in each of these bills. So let's say Washington County gets to that threshold of 125,000. And they pull themselves back and say, yeah, this is going to be greater than that. We think that our project, we can do it for $200,000. And they do the numbers, and they think, well, okay, the private sector is going to come in at $250,000. Well, we can do it cheaper. So they can continue doing that. So the way the law works is very interesting. It doesn't curtail. It's not a cap. It doesn't curtail local governments from being able to perform a $1 million project or a $10 million project. It's just when they have to do that cost comparison to make sure that they're spending the money most wisely and getting it to whether it's a private sector or a public sector that can do it the cheapest. And I would think the legislature would want to keep that comparison as low as possible, because as soon as you elevate it, then, especially if you elevate it where all the projects fall under it, they're never going to be doing the math to understand the cost and being responsible with the public dollars when they're letting these jobs out. That's the general gist of our discussion on this.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Rich, do you have a history, of jobs that have been jobbed out so that you could take a look at the number of jobs that were over 125,000 and how many of those jobs were turned over to the private sector because they could do it cheaper than the county, and how many of those jobs the county could do because they could do it cheaper than the bids that came in?
Madam Chair, Representative Barreto, I'm not I think so. The local governments are supposed, in law, current law, local governments are supposed to file with the Bureau of Labor and Industries a form when they are going to do any job that's greater than 125 that shows that cost comparison. The issue is not very many of them get filed. And so we can't really have a good number to know what's going on, because I really think this is a paperwork issue myself. That's how I interpret this all summing down. They don't want to do that paperwork because it's not coming to BOLI, and that's current law. So if they did that, I could give you that information. BOLI could give you that information. But every time we ask BOLI if they have certain documents on a certain job, the answer is no. So,
follow up. So I think that would be good information to see about raising the cap as far as what between 100 and 250,000, whatever, how many jobs the county actually did do and how many they bid out. I mean, that would be good information to base a law on.
Yeah, because, Madam Chair, Representative Bretta, what we do know is the ones that they let out, that they were under 72% of them were under 125,000. All of those jobs could have been self-performed by the local governments.
And I just also wanted to, thank you, Madam Chair. I know that when we were talking to a group about this, that even though they can, even though local counties and local governments can do a lot of this work, many of them choose not to, like the city of Beaverton, for example, indeed does private contractors for almost 97% of its work, but they are still supporting this, not the least of which because of the fact that that threshold hasn't been raised in 20 years.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Smith Warner, we think the threshold is probably too high now because so many jobs they can self-perform anyway. And I actually thought about this. Their best argument is they're still letting out 97% of the jobs, right? And that could be a true fact, just like our fact of the number being about three-quarters of the jobs fall under the current threshold is probably a true or close enough true fact with some color, you know, because I don't think anybody sharpened their pencil completely on it yet. And we haven't sampled everybody. But if both of those are true, then why, if the local governments can perform almost all the work and they're still letting it out, why do they want the cap raised so much? And that's where you hit the exact point where I come from. It all is about paperwork. They don't want to have to do that paperwork, so you guys have color and understanding of what the local governments, how they're spending the money. And I get it. I've heard from some of the more rural communities where literally the public works director may be on a loader, you know, working on a project, and you wouldn't have to stop and have to fill out all the state paperwork to do that. We kind of feel the same way. But those are points that we should be negotiating to try to ease those issues for those kinds of counties that have that, you know, that kind of burden on them. But I think that's what this whole issue is just to raise the cap so much that nothing ever falls in it and they don't have to do the paperwork and the cost comparison, because that will be the effect of it if you adopt the thresholds that you have now.
Questions? All right, thank you. Gwen.
Chair Williamson, Vice Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, Vice Chair McLean, Gwen Baldwin with the City of Beaverton. I have had the opportunity over the last several months to be involved in most of the conversations that are reflected in the threes and dash sevens here today. And I do think that a lot of really good constructive work has come forward in this. I also think that this bill has continued to move forward in a fashion that the local governments and public agencies, from the special districts to the counties to the cities, vehemently oppose. And yet it has continued to move forward as the process moves forward and we are still having conversations. So what I would urge you to do is move the dash sevens, because they do reflect the vast majority of agreement of two pieces of the three component policy. And I think we have gone very far in trying to meet the expressed needs of the contractors related to not wanting to choose an indexing way of addressing it. And we also put a ceiling above 750, everything. So it doesn't matter what disturbance of 2 inches or what things would have been exempt before, everything beyond that would have to go through an analysis. And it is an important comparison, but it is not an insignificant undertaking to do. So part of what got established in 1997, I think, was really trying to take a look at what it would take to do that kind of road overlay, to do a public improvement. So to your point, 20 years is a long time not to have an adjustment, and we made a choice back in 97 to allow local governments the ability to do some of that work. I will tell you, for Beaverton, we've let out in the private sector projects as low as $40,000 because it was not something that we chose to do, wanted to do, or needed to do at that moment. And yet, if we don't have the ability to undertake projects that are larger, move our staff forward with the expertise and the skills they need. And to your point, Chair Williamson, you shrink the amount of what you can do for that dollar value. I think that there is not a problem in terms of suddenly we'd stop we'd do all the work in-house. We clearly aren't, because we aren't taking advantage of what we could do right now. But what we do have is the flexibility to be able to undertake the projects necessary as needed. So again, I really urge moving the dash sevens forward at this time, and our commitment is we will continue to keep this conversation going both as it moves to the Senate side and to resolution.
Questions? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move the dash A7 amendment to House Bill 3203.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved the A7 amendment into House Bill 3203A. And colleagues, just so you know, I have no intent to move this bill today, so we would just be moving the amendments. Discussion.
I object.
Okay.
I'll discuss. Can we discuss first?
Just to the amendment part.
Okay.
Can we stand at ease for just a moment?
We can. On. All right. Discussion. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say I do support moving the dash A7s, having inserted myself into this process in the middle of the session, as I have been inserted into other processes against my will over the course of the session. No, just kidding. I love everything I do every day. I just want to say I think it is and will be useful to indeed move this conversation forward in a place where both sides are truly feeling represented and truly feeling like they're going to get to a final resolution on all of those areas.
Great, thank you. Yes, Representative Barreto.
I realize that Representative Smith Warner always has good ideas, but it would seem to me that we ought to have the dash six out maybe before we move the dash seven, and so that we could take a look at that. My input.
Additional discussion. Sam, can you call the? Never mind. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I will support the dash seven. I'm a little disappointed we didn't come to a better agreement than we've had, but I fear that we're not going to come to an agreement on this. I know there's more conversations to be had. Hopefully, that will happen, and people will, in a timely manner, come to an agreement. I will note that, you know, I know there's a balance here, but I don't know that I've ever seen a spot where governments have put them in a spot where they can be held accountable quite like they are being held accountable in this bill. I've tried to hold local governments and sometimes state governments to follow statutes and find myself really troubled sometimes that it's hard to sue City Hall and make them comply to the law. So I know there's a balance in this piece, and I appreciate the local governments putting that forward. That's, I think, should be noticed. That's really a monumental piece in this bill, I think. So I just hope we can keep that conversation going on the Senate side, but I will go ahead and support the A7.
Excellent. Further discussion? All right.
Representative Breda?
No.
No.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Excused.
Representative Nose?
Yes.
Representative Warner?
Aye.
Vice Chair McLean?
No.
Vice Chair
Rego? Yes. Chair Williamson? Yes. Motion passes. I will close the work session on House Bill 3203A. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3456.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3456 permits establishment of photovoltaic solar power generation facility on certain high-value farmland, declares emergency effective upon passage.
You're not moving this today.
No.
Which can I steal from you?
Are we standing at ease?
Oh,
no, we're not standing
sorry,
at ease.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
There's a lot happening.
It's like, can I come over?
No, nobody can come over. Cool. All right.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which includes Umatilla, Morrow, Gillum, Sherman, and the best parts of Wasco County. Thank you very much for allowing us to be here today, and thank you very much for hosting a public hearing on House Bill 3456. I'm going to keep my comments extraordinarily limited, as I think the good folks from Umatilla Electric Cooperative will do a much better job explaining the issue before us. But what I do want to share, Madam Chair, is my appreciation for your consideration of this legislation. And for your consideration and a possible vote, I do understand that there's a possible amendment that might be coming forward that would make a good piece of legislation perhaps even better.
So excellent.
With that, if...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of Umatilla Electric Cooperative, and I've fallen for one of the classic blunders. The first is never get involved in a land war in Asia. The second, and only slightly less well-known, is never get involved in a land use bill in Oregon. However, that being said... Umatilla Electric Cooperative has, under the Renewable Portfolio Standard, become a large utility. As a result of that, we are in need of generating 100 megawatts of renewable energy by 2025. As we started down that road, we were siting a solar array on land zoned exclusive farm use. It had class 7-8 soils. And we discovered that the siting that solar array would require a Goal 3 exception because that land is within an American viticultural area. In specific, it's the Columbia Valley viticultural area. When you have EFU land and it has a viticultural overlay, by definition, it becomes high-value farmland that requires a Goal 3 exception anytime you're trying to build a solar array of more than 12 acres. Anything under that, you're building about a 2-megawatt solar array. Now, viticultural areas were created in federal code as a means of allowing wineries to provide geographic guidelines to basically indicate this is where this wine came from. However, Oregon in 2007 recognized those under Oregon law in ORS 195-300, and then in October 2011, this rule was implemented that essentially treats AVAs as a land use tool. So the problem we've got is that if we're going to meet our renewable portfolio standard, right now more than half of UEC service territory sits within the Columbia viticultural area. Now, I provided for the record a beautiful map. This map shows you the portion of the viticultural area that is around UEC's territory. This area and this area are the parts of UEC's territory. This is the area that's in the viticultural area. That wouldn't generally be a problem except for the fact that all of our infrastructure, our transmission substations, or most of it is over in this area, as is most of our folks and our industry and all that sort of stuff, and this is the area where it's best for us to place our solar arrays. Unfortunately, what that means is that if we were going to build solar arrays outside of the viticulture area, we have to either have to go way down south or over in this area that doesn't have transmission lines back to the rest of our service territory, which adds a rather substantial additional amount of cost. So we have introduced this piece of legislation, and I want to thank Representative Smith for not only working with us on the original bill, which was a hoot, but also the priority bill that allowed us to get the language we needed in the right relating to clause. This was introduced to resolve the conflict between our renewable portfolio standard and the statutes and rules which treat EFU land as high-value farmland within this AVA. We do this by the following things. The first thing is it allows us to site a solar facility on land that's zoned exclusive farm use if it's also designated as high-value farmland because it's in the Columbia Valley viticultural area specifically. It has to, for this land to have this exception, it still has to go through all the process that we have to go through for an exception to use it within EFU land. It has to not otherwise qualify as high-value farmland. Again, it has to be located in this particular Columbia Valley AVA, and it doesn't have access to water and hasn't had access to water or water rights for at least 20 years. The reason for that is a number of our members are both farmers and irrigators. They don't want us putting these sort of things on anything that can be used for farmland, and as a result, neither do we. And so we were trying to find a proxy that would make sure that we were not using land that would be used as farmland, which is why there's no water allowed. It also exempts it from being inside an irrigation district, because even though you could have land that's inside an irrigation district that doesn't have access to water, someday you might have access to water, so we didn't want to include those as well. So before this bill, our choices are essentially this. We could either go through a Goal 3 exception every time we want to place something that is bigger than 2 megawatts, and that runs generally between $150,000 and $250,000 because of planning and attorney's fees, whether we're successful or not. Or we can choose to build 50 2-megawatt solar arrays spread throughout our jurisdiction, which would then require us to put in a lot of transmission lines and substations, which our farmers don't like either, and as a result, we don't want to do it. So this bill is designed to overcome those problems in as narrow a way as possible. We work cooperatively with a rather large group of folks who are substantially more knowledgeable about land use than I am. We work with Farm Bureau, Thousand Friends, the wine growers, solar folks, and they have been, and several state agencies, all of which I think would prefer not to be named in association with this bill. But they provide us with phenomenal input and guidance in getting the language right, and also want to note Legislative Council worked very closely with us, and we're thankful for their guidance as well. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. Oh, well, I'd be happy to also talk about the amendments. My understanding of the amendments that are being worked on would further narrow the location where this could occur to only the area of Umatilla Electric Cooperative's territory that is within the AVA, and only to the extent that it meets our renewable portfolio standard obligations, so that it isn't something where we're building solar to sell it somewhere else, which we're not going to do anyway, but it's better that that be addressed. She's here for any clarifications if necessary.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, I'm just support staff.
We're happy you're here. Any questions for this panel? Right. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, just very briefly before we go, I just want to make sure folks know that I do economic development for a living, and UEC has a revolving loan fund, and quite often I work with UEC and the revolving loan fund to help businesses structure debt.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. Tim Cohen.
Madam Chairs, members, committee members, for the record, my name is Tim Cowan. The first thing is I want you to know that I'm opposed to the bill, and I don't have the same definition as the witnesses just prior to me on high-value farmland. But in research that I made, because I lived in Central Oregon for a long time, and when I was a senior vice president for the bank, I did Mid-Valley, Central, and Eastern Oregon. The high desert has 24,000 miles. And what I would like to see is to take a look at those 24,000 miles and look at any opportunities we would have to generate solar power energy and not use the land in the valley to do that. I did talk to a gentleman for Pacific Power and Light and Portland General Electric. And it might be a little different than what the people before me testified, because I might not have asked specific enough questions. But they said that they have programs now that are using solar-powered electricity, and that solar-powered electricity could be in the grid from those areas. It would be expensive, but it could be a commercial endeavor to do that. Just real quick, take a minute. One of the reasons why I'm interested in this bill is because my family homesteaded in the Lebanon area. And I had I helped Tom McCall with a speech, was his escort officer and protocol officer when he got a national award. And it's interesting to talk with him on land use planning, and I was also on land use planning in the Tualatin area. So that's some of the interest that I have in the bill. So my last comment would be, I would like to see us leave high-use land, farmland, leave it alone. We've got 24,000 miles of high desert, that there can be ways commercially to do that, but it will be expensive. And that's what I'd like to see us focus on. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you very much. All right. Let's close the public hearing, right? Close the public hearing on House Bill 3556. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3418.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3418 modifies the reimbursement methodology for health care services and supplies provided to enrollees in the health benefits plans offered by the PEB. You have a -6 amendment, Madam Chair. It requires the convening of an advisory group that, with the assistance of the Legislative Policy and Research Office, to conduct study and make recommendations regarding reimbursement of prescription drugs and medical assistance program, public employees benefit board plans, Oregon educator benefit board plans, and other state finance programs It also specifies in-network and out-of-network reimbursement rates for inpatient and outpatient hospital services or supplies for PEB and OEBB contracted carriers and self-insured programs administered by third party. You do have, we previously had a dash 5 amendment, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and we have the dash 6. The only difference is there was a omission from the underlying bill restored in this bill with regarding the prohibition against balanced billing. It was in the underlying bill, accidentally left out of the dash 5s. It's in the dash 6. So that's great. The only difference.
Thank you. Madam Speaker, or Representative Smith. Whoever would like to go first. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith, and I have the distinct pleasure of serving District 57, which includes Umatilla County, Morrow County, Gillum County, Sherman County, and Wasco County. Colleagues, I also serve as Vice Co-Chair of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means and have been active in the state budget for over 18 years. Well, nearly 18 years.
Thank you for that.
And thank you. And I'm pleased to be here today to offer my voice of support for House Bill 3418. I want to share with you, back in February, I had an opportunity to sit down with the speaker and to have a conversation with her about the state budget. And one of the things she shared with me was that it's really important that we work hard and diligently in a bipartisan manner to get our arms around cost containment. And I shared with her that I was most interested in working with her on this issue, and as she had ideas, keep me in mind. I'd love to visit with her. And I believe House Bill 3418 is one of those examples of a cost containment that deserves strong consideration. In addition to that, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I want to share with you that the Speaker and the Senate President put together a cost containment committee. And in that committee, we had the co-chairs of Ways and Means, myself, Senator Winters, Senator Johnson, and some professional folks who have expertise in budget management, including LFO. And during that time, multiple conversations were had around PEB and OEB and having a conversation about how best to contain costs. And I'm not going to go into deep detail on those conversations, but House Bill 3418 is in line with those conversations that, again, were held in a bipartisan manner. So I'm pleased to be here today. I'm pleased to lend my voice of support, and I'm pleased to support the Speaker in this effort as she proceeds forward.
Thank you. Good afternoon, colleagues. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House. It's a real pleasure to be working with Representative Smith on this bill. And as he has pointed out, there is a lot of bipartisan, bicameral interest in making sure our cost drivers are reduced here going forward. And there is a lot of work around OEB and PEB, and this is one portion of it that you will see in the 3418-6 amendment. This bill is part of a broader conversation, and it's about providing health services state employees with some contained costs. And it's very important that we have benefit plans that meet the needs of our employees. It's also making sure that we get the best deal for the dollars that we have. Health plans offered through the Public Employee Benefits Board, or PEB, cover over 136,000 state employees, spouses, and their children. In the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, that's 140,000 employees and dependents. So that's 276,000 covered lives. It's a lot of people. Since 2013, the legislature has aimed to keep these costs in check in the PEB system by capping the annual cost growth for health insurance plans under PEB at 3.4%. You'll remember that is also the cost trend cap for our CCOs under the health plan. The PEB board has generally done well to adhere to this cost trend through annual insurance contract negotiations, but I think we can do better, both in PEB and OEB, particularly on the side of provider payments, what we're actually paying in reimbursement costs. House Bill 3418 would formalize this effort to contain the rate of insurance costs by instituting reasonable guardrails on our health insurance costs in PEB and OEB. The bill does two primary things. It sets a maximum allowable cost for in-network hospital claims at 200% of Medicare, and it sets a maximum allowable cost for out-of-network hospital claims at 185% of Medicare. And I just want to point out, I'm speaking directly to the dash sixes. The original bill had other services in there. We are just talking about hospital claims at this point in the dash six. So if we look at PEB specifically, the current average inpatient-outpatient cost for the self-insured plans is approximately 237% of Medicare. This bill targets 200% for in-network because it is an achievable benchmark that moves us in the right direction. The bill would apply to both self-insured and fully insured plans on PEB, and the maximum allowable costs would apply to inpatient-outpatient costs. And I want to emphasize maximum. Not the minimum, the maximum that would be allowed. This benchmark would not apply to type A, type B, or critical access hospitals because of their size and different geographic regions. It wouldn't apply to primary care, behavioral health homes, or any other claim that could be included in a primary care incentive program. I also want to be clear that House Bill 3418 does not prohibit incentive payments or value-based payments to improve outcomes. It simply defines a ceiling that provider contracts must take into account. We have made this explicitly clear in the Dash 6 and have worked with stakeholders to ensure the bill will not have the unintended effect of discouraging value-based payments. The goal is to increase transparency in specific healthcare costs, set expectations for how prices are set, and ultimately reduce the cost of providing healthcare services to state employees. We can see the need for a measure such as this by looking at a few key data points that support the findings of a recent Quality Corp study through the Network for Regional Healthcare Improvement, which found that the cost of healthcare in Oregon is 17% higher than neighboring states with no correlating increase in quality of care. In 2016, there was a 6.8% increase in medical costs across all PEB plans compared to the previous plan year. Mercer actuaries determined that 3.2% of the self-insured cost increases were due to simple increases in the service cost, not increases in utilization or risk. We would not accept that level of variance if we looked at any other state purchase. The cost trends simply do not align with normal market trends. An Oregon PEB trend components analysis performed also by the Mercer actuaries in February of this year analyzed two basic questions asked by the PEB board. One, are Oregon's costs typically higher than other locations across the country? And two, what is causing the renewal increase for 2018? Cost increase, utilization, et cetera. This analysis compared geographic costs in different regions in Oregon to the average cost for services in the U.S. And hospitals in half of the Oregon regions modeled were charging average costs. Hospitals in the other half of the region surveyed were charging above average, from 7.5% to 15% greater, and of those, 75% were in the high cost category, over 15% of the average national price. So while the per unit price of procedures accounted for 3.2% of PEB's total increase, utilization only accounted for 1.4% of total cost increase, with risk accounting for an additional 1.4%. So what does this actually mean in actual service terms? Here are a few examples to help answer that question, to give you some actual details. Based on aggregate data of services and procedures, which you can review on OLIS, the state is paying up to 672% of Medicare to some hospitals, 672%. The number of cesarean sections across regions, for example, decreased from 2.1 to 0.1 per 1,000 from 2014 to 2016. Yet the minimum allowed paid claim for PEB increased from $6,314 to $11,655. This is an increase of 84% in cost and a decrease of 200% in utilization. Costs are going up while utilization is going down, and we're way above the Medicare reimbursement. We can talk about a procedure called guiding catheter utilization. That did not increase in terms of utilization between 2014 and 2016, yet the cost of this procedure increased 113% since 2015 and varied dramatically between regions. And there are other, I have other examples there in my testimony. So with these data points in mind, it's clear that 3418 with the Dash 6 could both increase transparency in pricing and result in considerable cost savings, both of which I think are paramount if we are going to be strong stewards of the dollars we are spending to provide health benefits for our employees. A preliminary model of potential cost savings just for inpatient and outpatient hospital claims at 200% of Medicare found that PEB could save over $30 million per year on the self-insured plans alone. For OEB, we could reap a 10% reduction in premiums and $47.5 million per year on plans offered by MOTA alone. That's a $155 million per biennium total funds savings, or $112 million in general funds. That's a significant amount of savings, colleagues. House Bill 3418 with a dash 6 provides a meaningful and achievable way to follow through on our commitment to reduce cost drivers in our state budget. I urge you to adopt the dash 6 and send this bill on to Ways and Means. This will be a component of an OEB-PEB cost containment bill that is also in the works, and this is one significant part of it. And so the sooner we get this to Ways and Means, the sooner we can wrap up the whole discussion on cost containment on the OEB and PEB side. Thank you, colleagues.
Questions? Yes, Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for bringing this forward. I remember parts of this in healthcare, but honestly haven't wrapped my head around all the amendments, and I apologize for not having done that. The hospital rate cap you mentioned of 200%, and it has to do with the services and supplies. What all does that encompass?
Madam Chair and Representative Hack, not to get into too much detail, but my understanding is the way we've had this drafted is that 200% for in-network or 185% of Medicare for out-of-network would apply to inpatient or outpatient claims for hospital care.
Does that include, can I follow up, sorry? Would that include prescription drugs? Would that include anything and everything included under supplies and services?
Again, Madam Chair and Representative Hack, for the claims for inpatient or outpatient care is my understanding. This does not go into pharmaceutical costs, although you'll see in the dash 6, we borrowed an important section from Representative Parrish's House Bill 3428, which would set up a legislative group to look at how we can look at reducing costs in PEB and OM on prescription drugs. It's a little more complicated. So this bill would just, in the dash 6, apply to inpatient and outpatient hospitals as a starting point.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, colleagues.
All right, Courtney Drescher, Marty Cahill, Doug Barber. Sorry, I can't read a handwriting. I blame it on Aaron's handwriting.
Yes, that's fair.
Hello. Good afternoon, Chair Williamson and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3418. I'm Marty Cahill. I'm the CEO of Samaritan Lebanon Community Hospital. I also serve on the Oregon Association of Hospital and Health Systems Small and Rural Hospital Committee. And on behalf of Oregon's 62 hospitals, health systems, and the patients we serve, we oppose House Bill 3418 and the dash 5 dash 6 amendment. The underlying bill, which applied reimbursement caps to the Public Employees Benefit Board, and then if you take in a myriad of services, if you then take a look at the Dash 6 Amendment, it then revised the bill to include Oregon Educators Benefit Board and then singled out hospitals services only. When you take a look at hospitals and health systems, we are increasingly paid based on performance and at-risk cost of care. When we take a look at going to fee-for-service, that's what we used to count on for reimbursement, and has more become a hybrid with adoption of accountable care models. And taking a look at Medicare rates that are established for the older population and for the younger population with disabilities, it doesn't seem like an appropriate measure for the general population. When we take a look at PEB and OEB being about 6% of the Oregon population, it's not evenly distributed across the population. So there's an unfair distribution. There's an unfair, there would be created an unfair reimbursement for some hospitals and not others, even if you take out the small and rural hospitals. Again, if you look at Salem, there's a larger proportion of folks in PEB here. So again, it would not hit all hospitals equally and fairly. It would be an unfair distribution. If you took a look at Samaritan alone, our regional medical center, we're looking at over a $5 million annual impact if this were to be passed. Again, the small and rural hospitals would not be would be exempt from it, but again, Lebanon would be impacted as well, part of a system that would impact us negatively. I think House Bill 34 is not the right answer. It creates broader consequences. You've got a cost shift to more commercial payers. You also start to look at our ability to fund community benefit investments overall. And I ask you to please be mindful of the unintended consequences of passing this bill and the negative impacts on community hospitals. I thank you for the opportunity to testify and would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Good afternoon. For the record, Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. And the Oregon Medical Association is very supportive of innovative ideas that effectively contain cost without limiting access to care for Oregonians. And although with the Dash 6, this bill now deals with just the hospital charges, the OMA still has concerns with this bill and another bill that is moving through the process of including Medicare as an appropriate rate-setting mechanism within Oregon statute. The actual percentage is less concerning than it is the use of the Medicare for this purpose. It sets a poor precedent, and it's really something that the OMA cannot agree to at this time. As a reminder, Medicare is a rate established by the federal government, and at times can be a politically charged process, and is not a rate that is negotiable. It is providers opt in to take Medicare patients, and agree to that lower rate, and sometimes in some areas a much, much lower rate, which is why they must have a very healthy payer mix of commercial, public employees, Medicaid, and Medicare in order to keep their practices moving forward. This bill could have some unintended consequences, too, with having a target of a rate in an Oregon statute. It's possible that this could lessen our ability to negotiate contracts with health insurers on other ends of the policy spectrum of commercial payers. So for those reasons, we have concerns with using Medicare in a rate of Medicare, a percentage of Medicare in Oregon statute.
Thank you.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. These are the health insurance agents who are in your communities, who work with your constituents, be they individuals, small groups, large groups, to find the best insurance product for them. We're here in opposition to House Bill 3418. In our perspective, in our view, House Bill 3418 would not result in cost savings, it would result in a cost shift. One of the reasons commercial health insurance is so expensive is that government programs, Medicare and Medicaid, pay below cost. Those costs do not go away, they get shifted onto the commercial market. A few sessions ago, Providence introduced testimony showing that commercial insurance pays providers between 120 and 125% of cost because Medicare and Medicaid pay below cost. Another way to think about that is your constituents could see a 20 or 25% reduction in their health insurance premiums if Medicare and Medicaid paid their fair share. By taking public workers out of the commercial market, which is what House Bill 3418 would do, and tying PEB payments to Medicare, House Bill 3418 would simply compound the problem. If the goal is to reduce costs in the PEB program, there are better ways to do that. If you have not seen the articles about PEB that were done in the Eugene Register Guard earlier this spring, I encourage you to take a look at them. They're in OLIS if you want to see them. A few highlights from those: Oregon's PEB plan is significantly more expensive than similar plans in Washington and California. PEB costs $1,700 per person per year. Compare that with Washington, where health insurance for each public employee costs $12,300, or California, where it costs $15,500. Hospitals and doctors don't get paid less in San Francisco and Seattle. Clearly, there are benefit package changes that could be done in PEB that could be restructured and that could save money. Public employees in Oregon pay 5% of the PEB premium costs. In Washington, they pay 15%. In California, they pay 23%. So if we want to save money in PEB, there are ways to do that that do not shift costs onto your constituents who buy their health insurance through the commercial market. And adding OWEB to the bill makes it worse, not better. And again, I think there are some simple solutions for saving money in OWEB. There are districts all over the state that are begging to get out of OWEB. They know that they can save money in the commercial market. In the 2013 session, there was testimony in the Senate Education Department there are 10 school districts currently that are either wholly or partially out of OWEB, so they know exactly what OWEB costs, they know exactly what they're paying for their commercial insurance. Those 10 districts saved $63 million over 3 years. If 10 districts could save that, what could 40 or 50 districts that might want to get out of OWEB save? So, and in that case, you save money and you don't hurt anybody else. You still have a pool for those districts that want to be in it, and you save money for the people that can find a better deal on the commercial market. So we encourage you to vote no on 3418 and look at other ways to save money in OWEB and PEB. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? All right. Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do have a fiscal impact statement on the Dash 6. It does need to go to Ways and Means, and we do have a no revenue impact on the Dash 6.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 6 amendment to House Bill 3418.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 3418. Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative Bretto.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I will be a no on both the amendment and the bill.
Representative Hack.
I am going to be a no on the amendment simply because, as stated earlier, I feel like I haven't had enough time. That's on me. To really look over that, and then I'll be a yes on the bill like I was coming out of healthcare.
Thank you. Any further discussion on the amendment? All right. Call the roll.
No.
No.
Aye.
Yes.
Yes.
Excused.
Yes.
Yes, motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3418 as amended with the due pass recommendation that the measure be referred to Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved House Bill 3418 as amended with the due pass recommendation and that the measure be referred to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion?
No.
Offended, isn't it? Gosh darn it. I'm going to have to be a no, but I may change my mind between now and then. I hate saying that, but.
Representative Foley?
Aye.
Representative Kenner?
No.
Representative Dose?
Yes.
Representative Warner?
Aye.
Vice Chair
McClain? Excused.
Vice Chair Wakefield?
Yes.
Chair Williamson?
Yes. Motion passes. I will close the work session on House Bill 3418.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, do we want to suspend the rules to allow Representative Kennemer to vote on the bills that we took up at the very beginning of the hearing? So we have a few here. One was.
Hold on one second.
Representative Kennemer, we voted due pass as amended on House Bill 2428. We adopted a Dash 1 amendment which allows an individual to submit.
I'm good on that.
Okay.
Yes.
So, yes.
We need to move to suspend the rules
so that Representative Kennemer can vote on the bills that, as Aaron explains them.
And I will. Yeah.
Thank you. My apology. I was in another hearing.
Yes. Go ahead.
Any objection? Okay. Suspended.
So House Bill 2428 to allow an individual to submit both signatures and the payment for voters pamphlet statements. That way, if signatures are not verified, they still have access. And then House Bill 2873, we adopted a Dash 4 amendment. It requires a municipal corporation who's going to submit to their district a bond measure or general obligation bond to provide that information to the county clerk, who then submits that information to the Secretary of State for posting on ORSTAR. House Bill 2927, which enacts the National Popular Vote, Oregon's participation. And then HJR 10, which is a resolution to for voters for impeachment. And then House Bill 3440, we adopted the Dash 3 amendment regarding the administration of naloxone. And then it is a due pass as amended to Ways and Means.
Yes, as the chief co-sponsor, I strongly support that bill.
And we did not move House Bill 2349 today. It was not taken up.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you for allowing that.
Thank you,
thank
Baron.
You, committee
Absolutely.
Members.
You just get the chief to come to the committee.
I will take the Fifth Amendment.
It's like get dessert
one,
money.
There's one more. Oops. We did adopt an amendment to House Bill 3203. We adopted the A7 amendment. We did not move the bill.
I'll vote no.
Oh.
All right.
That's it.
No more business?
No more business.
All right. With that, we're adjourned, committee. Thank you very much.
No more business.
All right. With that, we're adjourned, committee. Thank you very much. No more business.